Science Podcast for Tuesday.
Take three.
Focused on the geology and related terroir.
USGS. Oregon Science Podcast.
Hello and welcome. This is the USGS Oregon Science Podcast for Tuesday, October 27th, 2009. I'm Steve Sobieszczyk. As we teased last month, we had some flexibility with what we could cover for today's episode. Partly in response to the recent earthquake and tsunami that had struck the Samoan Islands earlier this fall, and partly inspired by a wonderful presentation here in Portland last week, today we're covering the science of tsunamis. In a few minutes, we will play an interview we recorded earlier with USGS scientist Brian Atwater and Oregon Office of Emergency Management Geologic Hazards Coordinator Althea Turner. However, first, a brief description about tsunamis. Tsunamis are typically a series of large oceanic waves or surges caused by the underwater displacement of a fault during an earthquake. They can also originate from other sources, such as a submarine landslide or a terrestrial landslide that has slumped into the ocean. Basically, anything that can move a large volume of water can potentially generate a tsunami. Generally, they are rare and often materialize as small disturbances. However, sometimes they can be massive, such as the Sumatra tsunami in December of 2004. Contrary to conventional wisdom, they are not tidal waves. Tides, in fact, have nothing to do with them. Unlike typical ocean waves, tsunamis can move across the open ocean at speeds reaching hundreds of miles per hour, speeds much faster than even airplanes. This is due to their very long wavelength compared to the ocean depth. When they reach shore, they typically don't roll or break like wind-generated waves. Instead, they surge and inundate coastal areas and sometimes flood for miles inland. Due to the complex interactions with the coast, tsunami waves can persist for hours. There are dozens of incredible videos online showing just how devastating and relentless tsunami waves can be. In some cases, the water seems to just keep coming and coming and coming. If you are having trouble visualizing the process, we also have links to some informative animations in our transcript that do a very nice job describing the complexity of the tsunami wave propagation. Make sure to check it out. Regardless of where they start, as tsunami waves cross the deep ocean, they are nearly undetectable to passing ships. Again, this is related to that very long wavelength. However, as the waves reach the shallower coastal shelves, a wall of water begins to form that can reach tens of feet high. Analogous to dropping a large log in a pool, tsunami waves radiate outward from the source in all directions. But due to the linear nature of the faults capable of generating the tsunami, a log makes a much better metaphor than, say, dropping a rock. For example, the 2004 tsunami formed along a fault that was 1,200 kilometers, or about 750 miles, long. Based on the source area, the seafloor topography, and the distance traveled, tsunami wave size can vary greatly at different points of contact on different continents. What may be a catastrophic tsunami in Japan may be barely observed in Oregon. Although tsunamis can occur in any ocean and impact any shoreline around the world, in the United States, generally the Pacific coast of California, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska faces the greatest risk. This has to do with the Pacific Rim and the dreaded Ring of Fire. But that's another show. Tsunamis are much more complicated than just a big wave. They represent many levels of risk. Not only is there danger associated with the initial surge, but subsequent waves are usually larger than the first wave. Also, all the water that had flowed inland must eventually recede, pulling with it anything and everything that's not tied down. Drowning is the most common cause of death, although with the loss of life, other damage from tsunamis can include flooding, the contamination of drinking water, fires from ruptured gas lines, and many other types of structural damage and hazards. In Oregon, the last damaging tsunami was from the great 1964 Prince William Sound earthquake in Alaska. Although Seaside, Newport, and other coastal communities experienced some flooding and damage from this event, including at least four fatalities, Relatively speaking, there was only minor damage, especially when compared to the effect of the 2004 tsunami in Sumatra. Recent studies examining earthquake-related soil deposits in the Pacific Northwest indicate that large earthquakes capable of generating tsunamis occur, on average, every 390 to 520 years. However, it probably would be okay to stretch that estimate to a range from once every 200 to 1,000 years. When these local earthquakes occur, there is very little time to issue a tsunami warning. In this case, the earthquake shaking itself serves as the warning. However, if an earthquake hits a long distance away, there is a Pacific tsunami warning system in place to provide notice for those along the coast to get to higher ground. Depending on where the tsunami originates, there may be anywhere from 4 minutes to 4 hours before the wave surge reaches inland. So if you live on the coast, make sure you're familiar with your evacuation routes. If you're not sure, we have a link for the online tsunami map viewer so you can check your evacuation zones and familiarize yourself with your risk. For more information on what a tsunami is, your risk and safety, and what to do, please check out the links in our show transcripts. Now, that should give everyone a basic understanding of tsunamis. Coming up after the break, we'll play the interview with Brian and Althea, where we pick their brains about what was the orphan tsunami, what should people in Oregon know about earthquakes and tsunamis, and what type of research is going on to help keep people safe. Stick around. We're broadcasting live from the Mission Theater here in Northwest Portland. We're joined by Brian Atwater, a USGS scientist who studies earthquakes and tsunamis here in Oregon and the Pacific Northwest, as well as Althea Turner, the Geologic Hazards Coordinator with the Oregon Emergency Management. We're going to cover a little past and present tsunami hazards here and tsunami history. I figure the way we'll set this up is, Brian, we'll have you cover the past, and then Althea, you can cover the present and future. First off, let's start with you, Brian. You just gave a nice presentation about the orphan tsunami, and for those here, our listeners who weren't actually here, can you give a little background?
Well, most tsunamis have parents, so for one sort or another, you could use loosely the metaphor of orphan for a tsunami that attacks a coast without the people on that coast being able to know that the tsunami was coming. So if the tsunami is generated close to you during an earthquake, then you'll feel the shaking. Shaking serves as a natural warning to get out of harm's way. But if you're far from the earthquake source, then it is far enough from its parent that you can consider it as an orphan.
And so when did this occur?
So our tsunami here in North America in 1700 became an orphan tsunami when it reached Japan, because they didn't feel the shaking. And some who wrote about it in 1700 were puzzled. They wondered why this arrived. I think I've got it here. This guy is great. Okay, seven times about the sea rose. Gradually became calm after that. Never heard of waves of rising condition because of village old and young trying to escape. He's saying that he pretty much instructed people to go to the high ground of the shrine, especially the very young and the very old, deal with these strange waves. Then he says, to the old asked, but unusual the wave's appearance, they said, so the village whole was puzzled. So it's in a Japanese syntax. I'm reading just a literal translation, but you see, he's saying that his villagers were puzzled by this. And then he goes on, he says, tsunami and such, what is called, such a thing could it be? For many years to come, remember well must. Earthquake and such happens. If that reason, this kind of wave and things like that come, it is said. But this village, vicinity in, earthquake did not happen. So he's saying there was no earthquake felt in my village or nearby, and yet people say that tsunamis are associated with earthquakes. His text in here is telling you, he's defining, he's not using the term orphan tsunami, we cooked that up just as a metaphor, but that's But that this is a firsthand account of somebody puzzling over this thing, asking from 309 years ago, he's speaking to you and he's saying, you know, where did this thing come from?
With that segue, how do we know where it might have come from?
First, if you roll the clock back much more than 25 years here, there's no knowledge in North America of a history of big earthquakes on our subduction zone. In fact, it was an open question in the middle of 1980s as to whether the subduction zone was capable of making big earthquakes at all. Starting in the late 80s, geologists began to recognize these signs on the Pacific coast that land had abruptly dropped and the sea had rushed in. And this 1-2 punch is very typical of big subduction zone earthquakes. As more and more of this evidence came to be reported by various investigators, it became pretty clear that this subduction zone does make very, very big earthquakes. And then the question became, well, how big? To answer that, we had to know along what length of coast did the fault break all at once. So how could we ask that? Well, the way we were measuring time was by death of trees. Trees that were lowered into tidewater as a result of slip on the faults that warped the Earth's surface and dropped these trees into the water. Mm-hmm. And it was tree death then that became the signature of the earthquake. And we had to ask the question, did the trees here on the Washington coast die at the same times as the ones down in Northern California? But still, that work narrowed the time of our most recent big earthquake or series of earthquakes. We didn't know which as of the early 1990s, but it narrowed that time window to the decades between 1680 and 1720. At that point, Japanese researchers said that's not very long ago for us. And we have a lot of written records from those times. And they consulted with their earthquake and tsunami historians who said, you know, we've been wondering where this thing in 1700 came from, and we've never been able to find a home for it. We know of tsunamis that came from South America as long ago as 1586, but we don't know where this thing from 1700 came from. So for the Japanese researchers, Cascadia then became the long-lost home for their orphan tsunami of 1700.
So it's a big geologic detective story that you
get. It's more than a geologic detective story. I mean, there are the historians in Japan going to libraries, going to the homes of prominent families, and leafing through old documents and noting every instance where somebody 300 or 400 years ago wrote about a tsunami or wrote about an earthquake, and building a catalog. Country, you know, and this was a monumental effort carried on in an incremental fashion by different groups of people. And for our tsunami of 1700, the first person to recognize it was a guy working as a volunteer. He was a secondary school teacher. He became Japan's volunteer earthquake and tsunami historian in the years going up to World War II. So Musha's work came out during the war in 1942 and 1943. He issued these things in mimeograph. His final volume wasn't complete at the time of firebombing of Tokyo, and he buried the manuscript 3 meters deep in a galvanized steel box in the backyard of his seismologist mentor.
Trying to segue into Oregon, there's good documentation for Japan with the 1700 tsunami. To the extent that was impacted with Oregon and the Pacific coast here.
The estimate is that the whole length of the subduction zone from Vancouver Island down to Cape Mendocino, California, broke during the 1700 earthquake. So that includes all the Oregon coast. And it was geologists working on the many bays and river mouths of the Oregon coast that anchored that story in Oregon geology.
Ethia, now it's your turn. Brian was nice enough to cover the past tsunami hazards in Oregon. So what is the status and how is the response effort set up for Oregon currently?
Well, the way Oregon is set up is what we're called is a home rule state. All disasters are local. And so what will happen is the city will respond first. If they can't handle it, then they turn to the county. If the county can't handle it, then the county turns to the county next to them, and so on and so forth. So the state has the framework, but it's the counties that really do the heavy lifting. And they're quite a ways, you know, forward in getting prepared for this sort of a level. It's kind of hard to wrap the brain around because of the fact that there's going to be so much destruction and it is going to be so bad that it's hard to prepare for.
Is there any particular areas or communities along the coast that are at higher risk where there's more concern or more focus set aside for tsunami warnings?
Well, everywhere on the coast is at risk. I mean, it doesn't even have to be on the Pacific coast. There can be anywhere that the ocean touches the land, there can be a tsunami. What we're concerned about is there are some communities on the coast that don't have high ground to get to, because the first thing that we tell people is if you feel an earthquake and you're on the beach, get inland and get uphill. Because that tsunami, if you feel the earth shaking, that tsunami is just literally minutes away. And so there are some communities on the coast, such as Seaside in Oregon, Long Beach and Ocean Shores in Washington, that simply don't have high ground to get to. And so there they're looking at building structures, building either a building or berms, or, you know, looking at different types of structure that they can then have safety.
Are you just concerned about flooding, or what are other possibilities or other concerns associated with the tsunami or the earthquake that goes into your guys' policy of, you know, how people should respond or what people should know?
Well, the first thing to remember is this is going to affect the Pacific coast from Northern California all the way up to British Columbia, from the coastline to the Cascades. That is a huge swath of land. There are millions of people that are going to be affected by this. They may not be killed, but they will definitely be affected, because it will probably be weeks before we get any kind of supply lines of food, fuel, water going again. And so that's why we tell people that they really need to have at the minimum a 3-day supply of food and water. We tell people to have a minimum of 1 month's worth of medications, especially if it's, you know, necessary for their life. And to take real personal responsibility there for making sure that they're ready.
Going along the lines of some of the topics discussed during today's presentation, there was references of tsunami/earthquake buildings that are designed to withstand both forces that people can use as possible evacuation, because granted, getting to higher ground is a great idea, but when you have thousands of people all clogging up the roads to get to higher ground, they might need other sources of safety. Do you have any knowledge of what's being designed, what's available, what's planned in the future for alternate means of safety in these coastal or at-risk areas?
Sure. I'll get to the buildings in just a second, but when you say clog up the roads, the first thing we want to tell people is do not get in your car. Do not drive. Because if it's the earthquake, there's going to be down power lines, down power trees, there's going to be buildings knocked over. You're not going to be able to drive, and that's time you've wasted that you're going to need to spend running. Okay, do not get in your car. And back to the tsunami refuges, they can take a number of forms. It can be as simple as a berm. Washington State has a series of these planned. They're starting in Long Beach, and so basically what they're going to look like is just another sand dune, but they're going to be engineered so that when an earthquake comes, you're not going to have the lateral spreading that you're going to see in other kinds of dunes, especially if they're water soaked. And so a berm can be engineered to look exactly like any other sand dune out there, but that's going to give you a refuge to get to. And then there's different types of buildings. One could be a platform for viewing whales. It could be an observation deck that's, you know, part of the tourist landscape. Be a hotel, or like what they're planning in Cannon Beach, which is the City Hall renovation. So there's a whole range of types of structures. It just depends on what does a community want. You know, some communities are not going to put in a 6-story to 12-story hotel on their beach. They might go with some of these less impactful structures.
People who are listening to this, they may want to go online, or they may want to talk to somebody to find out more if they're at risk, or what they should do if they feel an earthquake, or if they want to know if they're in their evacuation routes. Are there websites, are there places established where people can actually learn more about what to do in response to an actual tsunami before it happens?
Absolutely. You can go to tsunami.gov. That's run by NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Association. That's pretty easy to remember, tsunami.gov. You can go to the Dogami website here in Oregon. Just Google Dogami, Oregon, geology, and they'll take you to a web page.
So what you're saying, there's a lot of information out there. People just have to make the effort to look.
Okay. Yeah, Google is your friend.
Very nice. Okay, well, Althea, thank you for spending time with me. Okay, thank you for your time,
okay,
Brian.
Well, thank you very much, Sylvie. Okay.
Welcome back. As we mentioned last month, this year's Geological Society of America annual meeting was held here in Portland. The theme of the event was From Volcanoes to Vineyards, Living with Dynamic Landscapes. Final estimates put the headcount at over 7,000 guests. They were mostly scientists, however, there were some media members, administrators, vendors, and students as well. All told, there were over 4,000 abstracts submitted and 160 topical sessions, not to mention all the posters, keynote addresses, discipline sessions, short courses, and field trips. There were experts on climate change, planetary science, hydrogeology, evolutionary biology, landslides, mining, earthquakes, and health and safety. A number of universities held alumni banquets, and our own acting director, Suzette Kimball, hosted a USGS meet and greet. There was never a shortage of things to do or people to see. It would take too long to highlight everything, so keeping with the theme of this year's event, we'll briefly describe something focusing on vineyards and something dealing with volcanoes. There were a couple of field trips that examined the regional importance of how certain geologic settings help produce quality wines. For example, one field session looked at how folds and floods help establish the right environment for producing fine wines in the Columbia River Basin. The idea of regional flavor, or taste of the place, is what the French refer to as terroir. Similarly, another field trip focused on the geology and related terroir of the Willamette Valley. Although it may seem silly, the regional flavors produced by the underlying geology is critical to producing good wine. There's actually an important science that goes into selecting the right area to start a vineyard. Besides the vineyards, another extremely popular topic was Mount St. Helens. Due to its proximity, recent reactivation, and subsequent termination, and the robust documentation and research surrounding it, people couldn't get enough. There were a number of field trips to the area that examined everything from the landscape of the north flank to the peripheral lava tubes. Since it was a very dynamic yet easily accessible area, those traveling to the region for the first time made every effort to experience our region's most active volcano. Along with the field trips, there was an assortment of related posters, presentations, and discussions. We could keep going, but it would take hours to cover the full GSA experience. If you're interested in more information about this year's meeting, head over to the GSA website at geosociety.org. You can review all the sessions and research presented. Make sure to mark your calendar for next year's annual meeting. It will be a mile-high Halloween as Denver hosts from October 31st to November 3rd, 2010. That's all the time we have for today's episode. Make sure to check out our transcripts for all the tsunami and GSA links mentioned in this month's episode. For those who subscribe through iTunes, you can access the transcripts at our website, or.usgs.gov/podcasts. If you have any questions or comments about the USGS Oregon Science Podcast, email us at oregonpodcast@usgs.gov. As always, thank you for listening. If you want to hear more about other research the USGS is doing around the country, please check out the other USGS podcasts at usgs.gov/podcasts. Until next time, I'm Heather Bragg. This podcast is a product of the U.S. Geological Survey, Department of the Interior.